morning, everybody. We're going to devote quite a bit of time to the conceptual framework. And we start with a discussion of a very interesting paper written by our colleague Tom Linsmeyer. Tom, you would like to introduce it, I suppose.
Yes, I'd like to do that as briefly as possible because I really would like the commentary, but let me give a little frame to it. My presentation starts with a disclaimer, and it's a little bit unusual that I want to point out that my colleagues on the board have not provided input to this paper, and they may disavow themselves from those views, and Russ may disagree most with the views as we come forward.
We really don't need this disclaimer.
But it's part of the normal job. This approach... I was asked to do a speech to think about the statement of financial performance, and as I did that, I also thought about if we rethought about the statement of financial performance, what implications it might have for other aspects of financial reporting. And so what this does is talk about rethinking about the statement of financial performance, particularly with concern that we cannot very effectively define OCI or profit and loss, and how we might begin to think about that, but then how an income statement focus might cause us to think a little bit different about measurement. Now, some in reaction to this paper might say this goes a little bit too far to just an income statement focus about measurement, but that's what the framing of this particular argument is about, emphasizing the income statement. So this integrated approach to presentation and measurement on the second slide really focuses on separate presentation of items in the statements of financial performance. I put an S there because the possibility, I think, from my view, arises that we might have two statements, one ending with operating income, to emphasize maybe the most important income number, with different implications for the analysis, and the focus is on separating operating items from non-operating items and separating one-time items from recurring items, both of which I regularly hear from our stakeholders is the focus of their analysis when they're investors, is to be able to highlight operating because that's the core activities, that if a company is not successful at those activities, they're not really interested in investing in them, and being able to segregate out one-time items from recurring items because in some respects there's a worry that if you bury a one-time item within a recurring item, it might be evaluated as having more implications for the future than it does. And that's part of the problem of moving to fair value, that if we get the one-time parts of fair value and put them into a recurring line item, people may overreact that that one-time change in value would recur. And therefore, an overemphasis may result. And if we were to segregate that, there might be less resistance to fair value in appropriate settings.
Just one question before you go on.
Sure.
Why would this one-time issue be so closely related to fair value? I mean, it can happen in amortized costs as well, doesn't it?
Yes, you're right. You're right. It's in both places, but I think some of the resistance to fair value is for the incremental unrealized gain or loss, which is related mostly to change in a discount rate for the current period, that get buried within an item and recur, and that's part of the resistance to fair value, but I agree with you entirely. It's throughout the whole system. And then what I did, based on what I thought about in terms of the statement of financial performance, thought about implications from an income statement focus for historical costs versus fair value measurements, where in the end I thought that the key issues we ought to think about is isolating on when unrealized gains or losses provide incremental useful value in evaluating a company. And that might occur when there is the possibility that you sell that asset. And that led to two conditions about when you have the possibility of selling the asset, either a disincentive to sell or an inability to sell because of either legal or market impediments. So the third slide talks about the key to thinking about operating and non-operating is perhaps having to define operating and non-operating. And in the staff draft for the statement of financial presentation that's on both boards' websites, we simply said operating as assets and liabilities used in or arising from day-to-day business of an entity and changes in those assets and liabilities. That seems rather generic. So I also teed up another set of possibilities of how you might define operating and non-operating on this slide as just a starting point for people to begin to think about whether we could effectively define those two terms, because it would be very important moving forward if that's the key division within statements of financial performance. And so on that slide, there's a suggestion with operating focusing on transactions with customers, suppliers, and employees, not operating being everything else, but just as important in financial statement presentation, indicating operating can also be some transactions that are both operating and finance. We had a category called operating finance where we had a hard time saying, what is a pension liability for normal service costs? It's a payment to employees for labor, but it's also a form of financing. What would be demand deposits for a financial institution? It's a financing, but it's also the key operating metric to supply the ability to issue loans in a financial institution. What do we do with those items that are both? In financial statement presentation, we said, let's call that operating finance and putting it in the operating section. But to the extent a user would like to think about finance aspects of it, labeling it both ways, they could also move it around in their analysis. And I think that would be important in this division. I find the advantages of rethinking about the statement of financial performance on the fourth slide is, first, it's being the definition I provided in the prior slide is makes it easier to identify operating from non-operating. But I think it also, most importantly, takes the focus off of trying to define what net income or profit or loss is. I don't think we've been effective to do that. We haven't been able to define other comprehensive income. But if we were really to focus on what users focus on, operating and not operating, that would be far easier, my view, to define. And that's why I proposed that as an alternative way of thinking of statements of financial performance. I also think it has the advantage of putting less pressure on whether we ever need OCI. I think the demand for it is diminished, if not potentially eliminated, in those settings, because almost all of what we put in OCI would be in the non-operating section. Okay? And if that were the case and non-operating numbers were de-emphasized and we know what one-time wealth effects are there, segregated, do we need a special label? Is the de-emphasis by putting in a non-operating sufficient? That's an open question, but I think it is a possibility for us to consider going forward. Okay. So in addition, non-operating activities, by definition, don't become operating. So the notion of recycling between categories would go away. Right. So are there any exceptions, I ask, on the slide or in the paper? Perhaps cash flow hedges remain an exception, and we just call it an exception. Perhaps, I'm saying. And foreign currency translation gains or losses perhaps are an exception to get to the same reporting unit. But they could be viewed to be non-operating in nature until they become transaction gains or losses, and then they'd either go in operating or non-operating depending on where, what particular accounts they were attached to. But if this were so, would this provide an opportunity to develop a consistent conceptual basis for OCI in any recycling, or perhaps allow us to have so few of those items that they just be limited exceptions for unusual circumstances within the model? And that's what I perhaps think both of those would have to be. I don't like cash flow hedging that much, but if we had to have it, it'd be an exception. Now, let's extend what happens in a rejiggered statement of financial performance to think about measurement. And it would be very much so from a focus of an income statement, where I think most of our emphasis has been that measurement's been thought from a balance sheet perspective, or at least that's the bias people think. What if we just take an income statement focus to this? And Akua's paper last time and some discussions with the ASBJ has caused me to become aware that historical cost is not necessarily one class of decisions. I think there's two forms of historical cost, at least two forms, from my view that I found going over time. So the first one is the original transaction price or recognition amount is allocated without remeasurement to income of a period. It's just an allocation method. But then sometimes that original transaction point cost or recognition amount is remeasured. but only the cash flows are remeasured when it's historical cost, without any remeasurement of a discount rate, if there is any discount rate. I think that's an interesting, different aspect of historical cost that we don't concentrate on. Because I juxtapose that to fair value that has you remeasure all of the cash flows and all of the discount rate. That's what the concept of fair value or current value is. So it's a step towards, in a sense, full fair value remeasurement or current value remeasurement within a historical cost system by concentrating on remeasuring the cash flows only. And that may give us a different thing to begin thinking about, because when we move from that second category of historical cost to fair value, that means we have to be thinking about when we would like to remeasure even more cash flows, sometimes upwards, and when we would think it's important to remeasure the discount rate in portraying the economic performance of a company. And I think those are interesting challenges for us to think about in the conceptual framework for measurement. So I now have three categories to think about when I think about measurement that makes it harder, but I think more interesting. In terms of the big picture item that we've been all concentrating on when we talk about a measurement chapter of the conceptual framework, the sixth slide talks about the selection between the two types of historical cost and fair value measurement. And if from this particular perspective, from a statement of financial performance, I base my thoughts on the objective of financial reporting, which says resource providers in determining the cash flows they expect from the entity, from their investments, desire information on two things: the amount, timing, and uncertainty of net cash inflows to the entity, and how an efficient and effective management has discharged its responsibility to use entity's resources. That second item is tied to the focus I have in the paper on unrealized gains or losses. Because an unrealized gain or loss is the amount that you would realize if you sold something rather than continue to hold it. And that tells you something about management's decisions to hold rather than sell, a stewardship notion. So that leads me to focus, first of all, on the first one, saying amount, timing, and uncertainty of net cash inflows on the statement of financial performance, because it attaches amounts to periods, and it allows you through time to think about uncertainty in the returns over periods, both of which are not the focus of the statement of financial position. So like most of the people that talk to us that are our stakeholders, they think the income statement's the most important statement. And I think that's tied in some respects to the objective of financial reporting. But then it also leads me to say the choice between an historical cost measure and a fair value measure is simply the difference or increment in the income statement is whether or not you include unrealized gains or losses in the income statement. Because most of the time people argue as if a fair value measure full change, that full change gets reported in one line item in the income statement. It's not true. We divide the full change in a debt security into its interest income and expense, an impairment on the debt security, and the unrealized gain or loss is just the incremental change beyond those two to describe the full change in fair value. And that causes me to think differently about how I think about fair value, because in the academic world, there's an argument that a full fair value change is a random walk, a random thing that is redundant in the income statement if I know the full fair value change in the balance sheet. But it is not redundant if you think about the interest income or expense line for a fixed rate instrument that recurs every period. There's a fixed amount of principal, a fixed rate of interest, it's going to recur over time. That one's going to repeat. The impairment's not, and the unrealized gain or loss is not, but you get different implications about predicting future cash flows and economic performance by dividing the fair value change into components that are recurring and non-recurring. And there's information to be learned from that process. So the factors I suggest in selecting between historical cost and fair value measurement move off what we tend to say when we talk about this as an intent-based model. What does management intend to do? That's not what I'm talking about here. What I'm talking about here is a model that says what management might be able to do as economics change over time with the company with the particular item. And ask the question, unrealized gains or losses are decision useful in meeting the objective of financial reporting if there's a potential that an asset or liability will be sold or transferred before the maturity date or the end of the useful life, because with that potential, the unrealized gain or loss will be realized. And I think some of our arguments that we have struggles with is we start with a model that say, what does management want to do with certain assets? But when economics change, they rationally want to change what they're going to do with that asset. And if they can get out of the asset then, I think an unrealized gain or loss makes some sense in reporting. But if they can't get out because either they are restricted from doing so legally or because there's no market, or they have a strong disincentive from being able to sell it, then the unrealized gain or loss will have no value. Because what happens with unrealized gains or losses, if you hold an asset or liability maturity, it reverses to zero. And so what value do you have in reporting an unrealized gain or loss if by the end the changes just reverse out to zero? I don't think there's much value there, and that's what this slide talks about. But it opens up the possibility of thinking of alternative situations where you might realize an unrealized gain or loss. And then having management's decision to hold rather than sell would tell us something about stewardship, and it would give us a foreshadowing of what might be the realized amount in assets or liabilities that you can transfer before maturity there under their useful life. So the factors in selecting between historical cost and fair value measurement that I discuss are no disincentive to sell the asset or settle the liability. And that is the asset or liability used in an internal manner that makes it economically unwise to sell or transfer it before maturity to the end of a useful life? The most likely circumstance there is when assets are used synergistically with each other. And selling that asset destroys your ability to create value because you don't have all the assets there to create the value. That would be an impediment from sale, even though there might be a market to sell. But there's also impediments for preventing sale. Most liabilities can't be transferred because no one wants to take on my credit risk if I'm the person that owes, right? So there's restrictions from transfer liabilities, and often there aren't markets for transfers of certain assets. The interesting thing is, if you think about markets for assets, those assets that you don't have a disincentive to sell tend to have markets. Those that you have a disincentive to sell tend not to have markets. So it's almost in the asset side that the first condition decides whether there's an existence of markets or not, secondary markets. So the outcomes of applying that thought process is financial assets would tend to be remeasured to fair value because there's an opportunity to sell those assets. There is a market often exists, and there's no disincentive to sell because you can extract yourself from that asset because it's not used synergistically with others within the company. In contrast, assets necessary for operations, including intangibles used in operations, would tend not to be remeasured to fair value because they are used synergistically together within the entity to create value, and therefore there's a disincentive from selling those particular assets. And few liabilities other than derivative liabilities would be remeasured to fair value because there often is a legal restriction on transfer, and therefore there's no opportunity to transfer those liabilities. Slide 10 talks about now further thoughts I had after reading Akuo and the ASBJ paper last time. Factors in selecting between the two types of historical cost measures, just allocation or when do you remeasure? So when would I just allocate? I suggest here, not in the paper, when the expected cash flows do not materially differ from expectations at recognition, just keep on allocating that original recognition or transaction price over time. But if those cash flows are expected to change or do change materially since recognition, we have the opportunity to decide whether we remeasure the cash flows downward or upward. And we tend on the asset side only to remeasure them downward through impairment. We don't tend to remeasure them upward. On the liability side, we tend to remeasure them both upward and downward, okay, both ways. And we do not remeasure the discount rate in those circumstances. So when would I do, when would I just do remeasurement of cash flows, when the expected cash flows differ materially from expectations at recognition, and the conditions for fair value measurement are not met? That's what I would do. And that particular observation comes to me and asks, remember, we've been having this prudence discussion over time. And the argument is that we ought to selectively think where prudence ought to be introduced into the conceptual framework, not necessarily as prudence. And the discussion was perhaps as recognition, dealing with recognition uncertainty, that's not here, but perhaps dealing with measurement uncertainty. This is a form of where measurement uncertainty might define that you remeasure assets downward, but you do, and you remeasure liabilities upwards, but reverse it too and downwards. That might be an area where you think of selective application of prudence concepts in dealing with measurement uncertainty. Note I said might. So measurement chapter of the conceptual framework, based on this analysis, it would seem a robust measurement chapter needs, in slide 11, three different sets of issues addressed. When do we use the following subsequent measurement methods? Where the difference is mostly about subsequent measurement, let's not talk about initial measurement, because there's very little difference between fair value and historical cost and initial measurement. But talk about when do we just allocate historical cost? When do we remeasure the cash flows and not the discount rate, if any, at historical cost? And when do we remeasure the fair value or another current value that says remeasure all cash flows and remeasure the discount rate period to period? That suggests we have to decide when to discount and at what amount. And we are woefully undersubscribed in any guidance about discounting. We seem to randomly, in standard setting, pull a discount rate out of our hat and throw it into a particular standard with no concepts behind it. And then the last thing is whether and if so, when and how measurement uncertainty should have an effect on subsequent measurement. And is it limited to the class of measurements called remeasured cash flows of historical costs, but not the discount rate? Is that where we want to deal with measurement uncertainty only? Because there's going to be measurement uncertainty when we go to fair value, but it might be more relevant if the unrealized gain or loss could be realized and you go to it. So the objective of this session is to get your reactions to all this lunacy and see if there's anything that you might think is worth suggesting that in updating the conceptual framework we explore moving forward in either the presentation chapter or the measurement chapter.
Tom, thank you very much. But could you explain to me one more time what you meant by this second category of historical costs? At least that's what I think you said.
So most of the time when I think about historical cost, we take the original transaction price or recognition amount if we create it. And what we end up doing with it is keeping that fixed and just allocating it to periods over time, right? Yeah. And that's how we normally think about historical cost stop. But if you think about it in the historical cost system, that's not the only thing we do. Sometimes when we estimate the cash flows that are embedded in their recognition amount or original transaction price, we remeasure those amounts. Contingent liabilities, warranty liabilities, we remeasure. And sometimes we remeasure an impairment just to the revised cash flows, right? That's what we do in impairment of financial instruments, right? We're remeasuring to the revised cash flows without changing the discount rate. That's a form of historical cost measurement. Where sometimes even an impairment, we remeasure to fair value. Why do we remeasure to fair value sometimes? That's an open question. I think we're remeasuring to fair value even in circumstances where we're only interested in the cash flows. There is no ability to transfer, and there's a disincentive from transferring. So there's an intermediary step of remeasurement of cash flows that's embedded in historical cost, not just at impairment, that doesn't go all the way to remeasuring all cash flows in the discount rate, which I think is what is fair value, at least in concept. Model-based fair value, or it could be observed.
Yeah. So, Tom, in the revaluing your historical cost upwards, for instance, which we don't generally do, right,
except for liabilities.
The useful information, yeah, the useful information out of that is it'd put up your operating costs, is that right? Because you'd have a larger allocation. Because, you know, if you've got operating and recurring as your useful information, and then you've got some fair value stuff because you can sell it, mm-hmm. unrealized, mm-hmm. you know, sitting there that's useful. But I just had trouble getting to the usefulness of pushing up your historical cost.
I think that we would argue the only time you push up your historical cost rationally is in the liability side. Okay? Well, I don't think it's ever...
Kevin, you beg to disagree.
I don't think... I think that's embedded in our system. Now, we could turn around to a balance sheet focus and say you need to measure assets and liabilities fully to understand duration mismatches, et cetera, especially in financial institutions. That's a different perspective. Yeah. This is a perspective that's looking at the income statement only. Okay?
Liesl.
Thank you. First of all, I think it's more than worth stepping back and looking at both the measurement choices and the performance reported a little from further back, because we're stuck anyway, so we have to find some room for maneuver, and that's more than welcome. If your choice is the choice that's sort of agreeable or gullible or however very nice to digest for everyone, I doubt, because I doubt that everyone is on the page, maybe I can say yet, maybe never. Some people seem to be so stuck on net income that I don't see them moving up to operating income, and I've witnessed so many debates on not agreeing on what operating income is. It's, I think, worth the try, but it isn't guaranteed success, so to speak. And one more thing, you talk about the unrealized and the upwards and downwards measurement. I think with the downwards, the point of realization isn't that obvious, and in some areas we're putting a lot of stress on when we believe things are realized or irreversible, and we have to bear that in mind, that going downwards sometimes is trying to capture the realized losses and not just unrealized up and down, and this is a very, very much a tension point. And our impairment rules indeed are all over the place so far, and we haven't rationalized them just as we haven't rationalized measurement yet.
Roger?
I thought the paper which supported this presentation was excellent, and I agreed with basically the whole paper. I think the choice of whether to use historic cost or fair value is that actually mirrors the discussion in the conceptual framework discussion paper, and I think that is the way to go, that operating assets or operating cash flows, users really like historic cost there, because that approximates the cash movements. So you buy a piece of inventory, you sell it, the selling price minus the cost, that equates to cash. And fair value there almost puts noise in the way of the user's understanding just how that value creation has happened in cash terms. But similarly, I agree that where an asset isn't an operating asset, it's available for sale, then fair value is the right way to deal with it. The one thing I wanted to focus on was the impairment, because I do agree that we don't have a consistent approach to impairment. I thought it was an excellent suggestion in the paper that we relook at that. If you take a goodwill impairment, that signals to the user that the cash flows you expected out of that acquisition are no longer there. And that means changing cash flows. Now, supposing the goodwill impairment, which can happen at the moment, is purely because the cost of capital goes up. There's no change to the cash flows, just the discount rate goes up. I see little value in putting a goodwill impairment in the income statement. It has no useful content to the user. The user can use his own discount rate to measure cash flows. I think that would argue for consistently using the original discount rate on all forms of impairment, be it receivables, be it fixed assets, inventories tends to be fairly short term anyway, looking at changes in cash flows rather than the change in the discount rate for the impairment. Now, I do agree that's something to do with what's loosely called prudence, and that's why I think we do need to unpick prudence and decide which bits of the conceptual framework does it bite? And I would argue it does bite an impairment. I don't think it has much to do with measurement uncertainty, though, because, in fact, you could imagine a situation where there is no measurement uncertainty, you still make an impairment. You have one item of inventory, you sell it after the year end, you know exactly what the price is, you still impair it, you still write it down at the year end if it was below cost. I think it's all to do with an asymmetric approach to impairment, because the user, if the user would expect inventory, fixed assets, goodwill to generate cash flows, positive cash flows in the future, and what you're really doing with impairment is saying, hey, your expectation is wrong, it's not correct in this particular circumstance, which is why we're doing this downward asymmetric impairment. So I don't think it's much to do with measurement certainty, but I do think it is an important part of accounting that we somehow need to put into the conceptual framework.
Alexander?
I'm back on slide number 3 here. And actually, I like that structure very much, because I believe this, on a very pragmatic point of view, is that how users look at statements. And this non-recurring division is very, very pragmatic, because they have a spreadsheet and they need a number to plug in the spreadsheet. So I believe this is very interesting, because the way the world actually works. But I would add, I have a minor point and a major point here. And the definition between operating and non-operating, I will add the business model here. Why is that? Because take financial revenue and financial expenses. It depends on the business model of the company, because in places where they have a high interest rate, sometimes a grocery store, a supermarket, have a strong financial component of their revenue. So they basically pay their suppliers in installments and charge the customers in cash, small amounts. So what happens is that the financial component in this business is actually an operational one. In other business, this financial component do not be operational. So the distinction of what is operational and what is not operational is not something quite easy to tell in advance. I believe it depends on how that given component reports. The distinction which concerns me more is the distinction between one-time and non-recurring items, recurring items. That's because today is a non-GAAP measure. So I'll take financial institutions, for example. That's the most important distinction. So if you go to every conference call, half of it is discussing the classification of non-recurring items that the company uses, and analysts are challenging that. So if you want to put this one-time versus recurring items on a GAAP measure, so introduce it in the conceptual framework, I believe we need a better definition of what it is. Take, for example, impairment of intangibles related to software in financial institutions. Well, you have that. Mm-hmm. One quarter you have it, the other quarter you don't. Blah, blah. Is it recurring or non-recurring item? Is that one time or not? So it's very hard to distinguish. It seems to be easy, because this is one time, this is a recurring item, but in practice, that's quite difficult. So,
I agree with you about both those points, and we struggled with those points in the financial statement presentation project, and we tend to take an accounting focus to this one, recurring versus non-recurring, and I think that we would err on taking an accounting focus to it and more try to think of an economic focus to it, and really trying to isolate one-time changes in wealth that have no repetitive implication, that it's tied to changes in market rates or prices, as a better way of identifying those things than whether or not we do the accounting for it every period.
I understand, but you look at legal claims. Are they recurring or not recurring?
I would say those are probably not those are recurring.
Yeah,
I would not put
United States they are.
Well, that's the point. So it's
but you have to remeasure bad debts every period. You have to remeasure contingent liabilities every period. I would not say those, even though the magnitude of the change is probably only one time. I would not put those as necessarily one-time welfare.
That's my point.
From
a qualitative point of view, it's a recurring item, but the amount is not recurring.
Right.
So I believe this flavors must be put in it.
I absolutely agree with you, but I agree with your premise at the start too. This is what investors are trying to do,
yes.
And I agree with Liesl too, that trying to do this will be a challenge. But I think it's a worthy challenge because that's what investors are trying to do, both of those things. And if management could help in the communication of trying to provide their views to that, I think that's a very useful thing. Doesn't mean investors have to accept it. Rather than creating this profit and loss account or net income account that is not a foundation easily from them to do their analysis, because the one-time wealth effects are not isolated and it's very hard to figure out what the non-operating aspects of it is from the start.
Some companies are ready to do that. They got to accounting profit here and then they add and subtract and say this is a recurring profit here.
And
they
I don't
themselves. Yeah.
And I don't trust the non-GAAP measures because I think you reverse out bad things but not good things.
Kevin.
Surprise, surprise, I don't agree with a lot of what's in.
I knew that.
Saying, but let me start with the broader comments. The way you're approaching performance insofar as the income statement measures it, there's a strong echo in what you were saying with where the performance project was when it started. And I absolutely subscribe to what you're saying there. Performance is a multifaceted thing, and we've got to get away from binary classifications of continuous variables. You're doing it again when you go recurring, non-recurring.
I understand.
The principle really is how recurring.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
So
and that's what I meant.
Yeah. The other thing that I strongly agree with is your endeavor to connect up measurement with economic decision making, and to try and get the relationship to how you will present. So I think that's all fine, and I think there was a line in your statement that the measurement chapter of the framework needs to rehearse these things. Where I start to part company with you though is that, implicitly you have got a concept of capital, and it seems to be proprietary oriented, and it seems to be thinking that fair value is the ideal situation if it can be measured, blah blah blah. And so you're trying to relate historical costs to these adjusted historical costs to when you might go to fair value. The circumstance you don't look at is use of an asset. So if I have an asset that is used, if I have a one-off change to the carrying amount of that asset and it's a depreciable asset, I get recurring depreciation through the period. So
if I remeasure it, yeah.
If it's an impairment. If you revalue it upwards, doesn't matter. We're talking about changes in depreciation one way or the other. So I think you overlooked the use aspect. And I noticed, looking back on some of the literature, particularly the work that Abudi, Bath and Kasnick have done, where they studied UK revaluations and Australian revaluations, which you don't have, but they traced those to try and see the relationship between revaluations and future performance, and they found correlations there. I don't think that's particularly surprising if you use the analogy of the value relevance literature on accrual accounting versus cash accounting. Why are accrual earnings more useful than cash earnings? And good accruals better than bad accruals? Well, in a sense, if you have a current value for a fixed asset, it's an accrual of a cash flow that's going to happen one way or another, whether it's that asset or a similar asset, to enable that business to continue. So you can see where I'm going. My concept of profit at the end of the day will be an increase in your well-offness once I've selected that measure. And I think implicitly you have a different measure, so you come to a different measurement. Whether you're right or I'm right or the DP is right, I would have expected to see a rehearsal of all of that in trying to make a sensible decision about measurement instead of bang into measurement techniques. I really bail out once we talk about a measurement attribute and a technique as if they are alternatives. And I would challenge the authors to think through where you've used valuation approaches or techniques and you pick them because they say something to you about cash flows. why have we got a fair value hierarchy? Why didn't you just have method 1, 2, and 3? What's the relationship between your preferred methods and any attribute that might have driven their selection? And it isn't there, and I think Tom is trying to get it there in the way he's doing it. I would try to do it in another way. So I think we've got a lot of work to do to get this measurement chapter thought about, firstly, in sensible terms, let alone selected from.
Stephen?
Tom, I agree with almost everything you say on presentation. I think we need to look much more holistically at the income statement, and operating income I think is very important, and the work we did on financial statement presentation I thought advanced it quite a lot, and I think we need to restart all of that, and as you say, it may take the pressure off OCI. On measurement, I disagree with a lot of what you've said, and you talk about what one of the ones is unrealized gains and losses, you say, are only really useful when there's the potential to sell an asset or settle a liability. Thinking of liabilities, which I think is where the greatest difficulty lies in measurement, I don't see how that works, because we've been working recently on insurance accounting where, let's say, you have a term life insurance liability. We're measuring it at fulfillment value with a current discount rate. Now, that is highly unlikely to be sold and highly unlikely to be settled prior to the maturity of that obligation. We have the same thing in pensions, same thing in IAS 37, where we have a current discount rate, and we have unrealized gains and losses, which are recognized and I think should be recognized. And it seems to me that here you'd be moving away from a current discount rate to a locked-in discount rate in that situation.
I think that's correct. I would classify the items that you just suggested into the historical class remeasurement category of cash flows.
Sure, but and then, a locked-in discount rate?
Well, that's the category I see that exists so far, and that's why I think the second part of the conceptual framework that I think that we have to decide is what we're trying to do with the discount rates and when we would remeasure and how. And so I will only observe at this point in time the second category of historical costs. You don't remeasure the discount rate. That doesn't mean that if we then developed the discount rate portion of that chapter more fully, we might reconsider. I don't believe any of those measures you talk to get to a market rate or an estimate of a market rate. It's a re-estimate of the cash flows, and then we'd have to choose how to discount.
But it's pretty close to a market rate. But the rate we have in insurance accounting is pretty close. We're not going to fair value, but it's not far off.
Perhaps. I think it's a constructed rate. As soon as you do not have credit risk problems in it, it's not a market rate.
It's very close to a current value, input current value. Yeah.
I understand that. But that's the discussion. I think I'm not advocating that this is the end. It's the beginning of a discussion, but I think what I put out here permits us to have the discussion. And if we address the three parts of the framework for measurement that I suggest, I think we have to wrestle to the ground the issues you're raising.
Ms. Fazer?
Thank you. In fact, it's a bit difficult. You know, you put your name tag, and the discussion is so rich today that, in fact, it suggests more to say. So I will try to be brief nevertheless. First of all, very interesting paper. I concur with what you said and others. And also addressing the issue that even if it is difficult, the measure of operating income is something to work on. And I would also concur with what Stephen said there. There had been some progress in the financial statement presentation project that is worth taking on. And we'll be discussing that later, I think. The thing that I don't necessarily appreciate in this paper is why would we be making so many efforts to eliminate information as of these other comprehensive income items instead of making sense out of them. I
I certainly agree that there is value for users to separate out recurring items, non-recurring items, but I think IS1 requires it already. And it requires it whether it is, you know, significant magnitude or quality. So that's already in the standard. If it eases the understanding, it should be separated out. Unrealized gain and losses, in my view, as exactly you pointed out in your paper, brings a particular information, relevant information to users. So in a way, I think it would be a pity to say, well, let's concentrate on the income statement primarily, and forget what supplementary relevant information, the financial statement, the statement of financial position can bring. So I certainly value the fact that the focus on income statement is surfacing again very prominently, but I wouldn't want to go into the other direction, which is to minimize the relevant information that the statement of financial position can bring. And I really see these other comprehensive income items and as being a way when that is necessary, and it's not necessary all the time. When it is necessary, I see really that as a good way of reconciling, in fact, the optimization of relevance in one statement and the other. So when looking at that, I think it is absolutely necessary to stop thinking of those items as being, you know, the dustbin or the political pressure, whatever. We have the opportunity to bring some rationale there, and we should not let the opportunity go. So to me, having the OCI disappear is just not an objective. I would agree also that the discount rate issue is a subject in itself that needs reasoning. So I also agree with what Justin said, but I think it's a subject in itself, and it's a difficult subject, so probably we should work on it. And then coming to the elements of measurement, the discussion of measurement that Tom brings, I think it brings an interesting perspective in differentiating, in fact, what we do when we select a measurement basis of this or that category. I'm not sure it's not what we would have called or the distinction would have been we would have made between entity-specific measurement basis and market-based measurement. And indeed, we would be driven by elements that you bring in your, you know, the ability to sell, of course, and whether there that there is an incentive, an economic incentive or not, as you developed. But I would also concur with Alessandro that all this, in fact, is encapsulated in the business model notion that we believe should play a role. So, in short, I mean, a lot to be pursued thanks to the this paper. But I would not forget on the Japanese paper and what it was bringing into the discussion. And I think the two can really coexist.
Well, this is a natural bridge to ICUO.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Tom. We have read this paper with great interest because it relates to our favorite topic about Professor Rosano CI. In our analysis, we have some positive and negative on this paper. Let me start with my positive reaction. This paper states that there is no differencing set of characteristics to define what items are included in OCI rather than net income. But at the same time, It proposes that the measurement basis be determined in light of income statement perspectives. Therefore, we understand that it suggests that the measurement basis for asset and liability should be determined if such measurement basis is relevant in light of financial performance. This is part of what we suggested in the December ASF meeting. I want people around here to read the December ASBJ paper later again, especially the definition of profit or loss is based on the measurement of asset and liability from the perspective of financial performance. Moreover, if in a hypothetical situation, if I'm asked to choose a single measurement basis for a single asset or liability, consistent with the proposal stated in this paper, I would choose the measurement basis in light of income statement perspective, because flow information would be more relevant for users to assess amount, timing, and uncertainties of future cash flows to an entity, although the balance sheet perspective is often more emphasized in the measurement discussion. We also share the sympathy to the suggestion that whether unrealized gain or loss is decision useful should primarily depend on the likelihood an asset or liability will be sold or transferred before maturity or the end of the useful life. This concept is similar to what we have stated in the ASBJ paper presented to December ASF meeting. Furthermore, we agree that the separate presentation of recurring items and non-recurring items would be relevant to provide relevant information for users to assess the amount, timing, and uncertainties of future net cash flows to an entity. And the next one is the negative side. However, we have been often...
you have 5 pages to go.
Sorry.
3 times longer than before. We have been often told by users that at least certain items, they prefer presenting current measurement in the balance sheet, even when unrealized gain or loss would not be considered decision useful. For example, users often request that fair value information be presented in the balance sheet even when some investment in debt securities are not likely to be sold. These users often say that the current measurement would be useful for purposes other than assessing timing, amount, and uncertainties of future cash inflows to the entity. Other purposes include, I guess, the assessment of solvency of an entity. Therefore, we conceptually agree with the view that decision useful measurement basis should be determined in light of financial performance. 2 different measurement bases have to be selected in certain situations of standard setting process, because financial statements are designed to present information with multiple objectives. In this discussion already, locked-in discount rate is not liked by Stefan, but in that case, we think OCI should be used. In other words, all of us to have considered whether 2 different measurement bases are necessary in light of presenting financial information relevant to show our financial position and financial performance. In the case of 2 different bases, OCI has to be used as a linkage factor. For these reasons, we believe that the use of OCI is still necessary, and in such a case, recycling of OCI is a necessary procedure. We also believe the presentation of operating income would be variable only when profit or loss meeting all-inclusive nature is presented in the income statement. Otherwise, operating income items may be missing in OCI. I understand investors mainly focus on recurring operating items. But this can be said more in a segment reporting. So this is not an issue only in the statement of performance. Thank you very much.
We go.
Tom, I like your paper very much because from beginning, I have a slightly different view from the board. That is, I would prefer to start with the discussion about whether there is a necessity to distinguish by some ways in the performance report. And so I agree with you and with Francois, we should dig into the purpose objective first. And then I have three questions to you. Firstly, in the financial statement presentation project, which I intend to dissent, the reason is I feel hard to imagine how can we distinguish between operating financing and investing. And it seems not so clear from this paper whether you want still keep financing and investing category. And frankly speaking, we did face difficulties to distinguish between operating financing and others. Here you use some examples like pension and the term deposit as example. My question to you is, how will you classify the transaction like leasing we discussed yesterday? You know, and if you want to classify as operating, how about the syndicate financing? You know, company borrow and then invest in the particular PPEs operated, were used for operating purpose. This is my first question. My second question is, on page 9, I think the overall concept behind your paper is the value realization concept. And this is one quite popular used by people. And but then I feel hard to link to our current requirements. Now, this is a question I want to ask you. Page 9, it looks like you want to, you know, say, you know, if very simple, use your word, as necessary for operating, including intangible and will tend to be remeasured, will tend not to be remeasured to fair value because they are used synergistically with other assets. Now, in our current standards, not US GAAP, we have three items which is popular: biological asset, revaluation PPE and intangibles, and also investment property. And will you say, based on your logic, they should not be remeasured or it's inappropriate? My third question is, the second slide, you start with operating and recurring or non-recurring. But it seems not so clear for me whether recurring will be still one of the benchmark you will use. If you still will be used or focus on it, why will not use the traditional classification like extraordinary or not? This is my three questions.
I think can we collect a couple of questions, and because we are running out of time, and I don't want to cut short the discussion, but it's very important. Kim?
Thanks, Hans. Yeah, I'll keep it short. Yeah, Tom, I thought your paper was very good, and I think that for me, I certainly welcome the approach of having some analyzed statement of financial performance. Perhaps I have some concerns, perhaps with the operating, non-operating, and the recurring, non-recurring. I guess a little bit skeptical, perhaps, around finding really robust definitions so that, you know, there's consistent application. Otherwise, I can see in practice there being a lot of, you know, debate and etc. So I was actually thinking whether or not we couldn't perhaps look at something more based on the nature of the items. So if, for example, we're looking at a remeasurement of an asset, is it the remeasurement of a current asset, remeasurement of a non-current asset, etc.? So more basing it on the type of income or expense item rather than having an explicit approach to say, is it operating, is it non-operating, is it recurring, non-recurring, and therefore from the user's perspective, they can see the nature of the particular item and can apply their own mind there. And then in terms of the measurement, your proposals on the measurement basis, again, I think that they are great as providing a good starting point for then each particular standard to then decide, okay, in this context, what is appropriate, etc. And I think, you know, picking up on some of Stephen's comments, I guess, you know, around discounting, we certainly have a very mixed bag at the moment. I mean, on financial liabilities, we tend to use original discount rate. If it's then I-37, we use current rate, etc. So I think your observations are, you know, are fair and you know, appropriate. And I suppose the challenge is to try and figure out, well, in what circumstances should it be an original rate, a current rate, etc.? Does it matter if you are funding it, and you know, etc.? So again, I think as a good starting point. Also, the other thing that I also really appreciated was the comment around discounting, because I really think the framework should address when transactions are financing versus non-financing. For example, we often talk about prepaid expenses or deferred income. Now, are they non-financial, or are they effectively, is there a financing element? So, you know, looking at your historical cost model around the original amount just allocated, but perhaps there should be some discounting of those. So again, I certainly think that the framework should address, is there in substance financing in a lot of transactions where cash flows are deferred or have been accelerated? Yeah, and then also just, you know, just a comment again, picking up, I think, on Wegu's questions around the around assets, is that you might find, I agree, an asset in isolation might be, you know, not available for sale because you need it for other things. I suppose the question then comes to, you know, well, how big can your unit be? So could you not sell that entire cash generating unit, that type of thing? So those were my main points.
Yeah. On the presentation area, on the presentation front, we have about four members that actually respond to Tom's paper. And I think from the conceptual angle, there's a lot of support for showing the operating, non-operating, recurring, and non-recurring. But obviously, you know, the challenges are, you know, the definition and whether we can get a common, you know, sort of commonality in definition of what is operating, and I think the difficulty has been raised by members before me. And in addition, I think one of the other perceived challenges is the fixed mindset of users in the market already, and it's a big job trying to, you know, sort of change that mindset. I think is one of the questions we need to ask is how are we going to bring the mindset of users from here to, you know, where you want to be, you know, for having your sort of concepts accepted. And well, I mean, in short, there is a strong desire to move towards that proposal, but the challenge is how we can sort of move there from where we are. And on the measurement, I think again, you know, a lot of our members are thinking that the most of the users nowadays, they tend to find the information most useful if they can predict how, you know, the financial position performance of the reporting entity. And I think, you know, your sort of new suggestion on historical value, fair value, you know, how should it be, you know, sort of used and under what circumstances it should be more appropriately applied. I think we have to look at it from the angle that how could we, you know, sort of make your proposal to be more useful and assisting towards the goal of enable the users to better predict the performance and the position of the entity.
Before I give the floor to Peter and Tom for some final observations, On presentation, I agree with much of what you have written down. I also think we need to do more work on the disaggregation of income to instill more discipline in the market and to regain some territory on non-GAAP measures. And it might have the advantage of decreasing some pressure on OCI if we find a better place for it in the income statement. Nevertheless, I think we have to be very realistic, and I agree very much with the comments of Liesl on this issue. First of all, if we succeed in defining our operating income, there will be a lot of pressure on our operating income. It will shift from OCI to operating income. For example, the changes in the discount rate of the insurance liability. I think it's pure operating income from the perspective of an insurance company. Would that really help the discussion? There'll be very the political discussion will shift. Also, I think that we earnings will probably remain dominant, and I think it should remain dominant as a performance indicator. The most inclusive definition for income must be dominant because of reasons of discipline. The temptations to leave things out of operating income will always be very big, and that will be especially the case for negative results. So I think we will not be able to escape this problem. But again, I agree we should try to make an effort. On measurement, I think this is obviously also from this discussion, it's the most difficult part of what we are trying to do in a conceptual framework. A few standard setters or comment letters have been very courageous in trying to develop a whole theory, the Japanese. It's a nice theory, but I don't think I can disagree with it. I don't believe in this dichotomy between the statement of financial performance and financial position. I don't believe that if one piece of income is not all that relevant for financial performance, that it then all can be all that relevant for the financial for the statement of financial position. I think if it's soft on the income side, then it's probably also soft on the balance sheet side. The Australians have done a very interesting job, which I can recommend everybody to read very carefully. It's probably, I have doubts about it, but I think it's light years ahead of what is acceptable to the outside world. But at least it was a very courageous effort. But I'm still looking for the Holy Grail. Mm-hmm. And Peter, perhaps you can help me.
Yeah, no, sorry, I don't have any grails of any kind in my baggage. But I think it's a very interesting paper, and I'd like to suggest four areas for some follow-up. The first is, and I think the most useful thing about the paper, by the way, is I think the way it links the measurement to the presentation aspects, and I think that's very valuable. The paper talks a lot about historical cost versus fair value, and I think that's probably oversimplified, really, and I think that doesn't work very well, particularly for assets and liabilities with determinable cash flows that are highly variable. So it's the derivatives, it's the pensions, where I think trying to describe some of those types of partially updated measurements as cost, I think that's too much of a stretch. I think we need a better description of those kinds. I think you go on in the sort of coda to the paper to talk about whether we want to update cash flow estimates and discount rates together separately or what. I mean, I think that's a better way to think about those types of asset and liability. And I think within that category of the derivatives, I think options pose a particular problem because I think the time value of options has causes problems of its own, which sometimes need to be thought about separately because you might want to capture the passage of time with those options or the way they swing in and out of the money. The paper makes quite a lot of play as well of whether assets are going to be sold or not, and I think that's oversimplifying it as well, particularly for financial institutions. Steve mentioned that as well. But I think if you've got a major duration mismatch, then it doesn't matter whether you hold everything to maturity, there will be an effect on the cash flows. And so I think just thinking about sale versus hold is only part of the story. I think it's useful to think about what users are going to do with the information, and thinking particularly of the sort of operating cash flows. I think, as I understand it, what they try to do is that they try and forecast cash flows over some sort of medium term, maybe 3 to 5 years, whatever they think they can get reasonable estimates for, and then estimate some terminal value beyond that. And so I think what we do for measurement and for presentation ought to be directed towards producing useful inputs for that process. To get to operating cash flows, that they're probably over the sort of 3 to 5 year cycle, they're probably looking at margins in some way. Now, that there's obviously a question about, is that sort of based on original cost, is it current cost, is it exit value? I mean, there are different ways of doing it, but it's likely to be based on margins in some way. And I think an important part of that is a point you make in the paper, that it's not enough just to take a fair value change and plonk it into the performance statement. I think it will need to be broken down into some categories, because people are going to want to do things with that, and just a single number that's an unanalyzed change is, in a lot of cases, isn't going to do the business. Sometimes it will, sometimes it won't, but I think we need to think of it in terms of how we use it. And the final point I want to make is you look separately at the cash flow dimension and the interest rate dimension in the sort of the coda at the end of the paper. I think interest rate may be capturing a couple of different things as well. I think it's not just changes in interest rates, but it's changes in spreads. And I think during the financial crisis, a lot of the biggest pressures that came up there were because of the way the spreads suddenly mushroomed everywhere. And that's why we got a lot of pushback on things that I think might have gone through before the crisis, but subsequently the way spreads behaved really put a lot more pressure on that. And so it might be we want to think about changing the interest rates and not the spreads, or changing the spreads and not the interest rates, but I think it would repay some separate thought about them. And similarly, within rates, I think some people sometimes capture things that have optionality within them in discount rates, and discount rates aren't really a great way of dealing with optionality.
Tom?
It is scary to put forward a paper as if you've got all the thoughts about something, and I don't. All right. I think what I was doing is proposing some different dimensions to think about in both presentation and measurement. And I'm gratified that we had a good discussion about those dimensions. And I think many of the issues that have been raised are reasonable and quality dimensions that we need to discuss to be able to build a solid, consistent framework going forward. All right. And so the purpose of really bringing this here was to begin the discussion, to identify the areas where we might have issues, and to begin to more robustly think about those items. I truly know that the operating, non-operating division is going to be a challenge. The recurring, non-recurring division is going to be a challenge. But the one thing I firmly believe in the paper is making an effort to do that will work and serve users far better than arguing about profit and loss and OCI and not isolating one-time wealth effects, whatever they are, because that's what I hear regularly, consistently, that users do. All the rest of the discussion, the measurement phase, some of you might know I'm a strong fair value advocate and from a balance sheet perspective, but I was providing you the other side of things. And so it is something that in a financial institution space, duration mismatching and those sorts of things would suggest there's other reasons perhaps to want to be doing a current value or fair value measure that we would think about differently than beyond what I've talked about here. But what I'm really hoping for is that we could spend the time to identify where we think there are interesting issues and begin to work harder at doing that, because I know my job as a standard setter would be far easier if we would have wrestled down some of these issues to a point where we have directional ideas of what we ought to do in standards, and then we have to make cost-benefit decisions in standards as to whether we would always provide or do what we say in the conceptual framework. But I do believe some of the weakest parts of my decision making is because some of these issues have not been thought through sufficiently for me to remotely be consistent in my thought processes. So I don't disagree with almost anything anyone says here. All right? They're all good ideas, and I think we have the challenge of trying to move this forward in a conceptual framework project to provide the foundation to have these quality discussions more consistently at board tables around the world. So thanks.
Well said.
Okay, thanks a lot, Tom, for instigating this very rich and interesting discussion. Shall we have a 5-minute break and then go for the other papers?